And here we are again. Hi, James.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's us with our coffee. The moment they start making, I was going to say coffee with alcohol, but they do. That's what Bailey's is
they
for.
They do. You bet.
Yeah. So here we are. I have a little quarantine woe that I'd like to share. I can't be alone in this situation. Is anyone else picking up beer, especially my local brewery's making all kinds of new stuff? I'm over there all the time picking up new stuff and, you know, hands-free and whatnot. But my little beer fridge in the basement is being co-opted by extra milk and eggs and things that don't fit in the regular fridge since we don't want to shop that often. So whereas I usually have a whole selection in my beer fridge to choose from depending on my mood, I'm now having to be much more strategic about what's cold and what's sitting on the counter.
You have a rotation plan. You have a little clipboard up there with your rotation plan.
I actually do. What's funny is that I'm trying to keep everything toward the front and keep all the ridiculous staple items that my children need for food in the back, because I don't care about that. But I need to see, ooh, there's no porter in the fridge. I better rotate that in. Which doesn't allow me to, you know, to binge, so to speak. You know, if I have a porter and want another one, well, my next one's warm. I got to move over to something else. This is really messing with my flow.
These are serious issues.
These are the kinds of things that drive people nuts during the quarantine. You know, I can live without seeing another living human for quite a ways, but when you, pardon my French, but when you fuck around with my beer flow, I got issues.
Well, I'm glad to know, and now everybody does, where your boundaries are.
Mm-hmm.
That's important.
It is.
Horrible problems. Okay, so what are we going to talk about today?
Oh, boy. Let's, we're seeing good conversations once again on the Discord. Oh, before we get into the topic, we have a webinar coming up.
We do, yes.
So on the 14th of May, we're having a brewer workshop. So this is for employees and owners of brewers. And, you know, if you're a brewer, please check out our website, check out the link, free webinar, and we're going to talk about taproom stuff, and we're going to talk about beer formulation, and just have a bit of a social time as well with our friends and our soon-to-be new friends in the brewing community.
Yep, it's going to be a ton of fun. Mm-hmm. We've got really good traction, lots of folks signing up, and hopefully we can try to give back a little bit of our info for free to these brewers in this tough time. So if any of our listeners out there are brewers, or they are looking for, or hopnologists, or just listeners, are have brewer friends that you think might be interested in this, please pass it along.
Yep, absolutely. Send it around. And, you know, I'm going to put a calendar entry right now on my calendar for the 13th to make sure I get the right beers in the fridge the day before so that I have what I want to be drinking that night during the because this is a, you know, I'm not driving home after this, so it's a casual event that we hope will get a whole bunch of folks showing up to. We're having a half-hour sort of social time before we get into the presentation materials, just to chit-chat and meet everyone. Mm-hmm. So please, please tell your brewer friends. Yep, and your brewer enemies. We'll take them, too. Totally fine.
Well, yep, you bet. Yeah, because your enemies, I don't care about. But, you know, they could be our friends. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's get into this today.
Okay. So the Discord, we've been having some conversations lately on hop aroma and what to look for, you know, as a grower specifically. It's one thing to talk about hop aroma when you're a consumer. And, you know, as you know, James, I'm always struggling with the fact that you have such a sensitive nose. And you've been doing this for a long time, sensory science, you can very easily explain what's going on and what's happening when you smell something, when you taste something. And I take a sip and go, that's good.
Exactly. It's funny because it's true. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's sensory science is a sticky wicket because it, everybody wants to have, as we've talked about in the past, an easy button. So if you could easily categorize and classify an experience, that makes it easier to understand. And it's sort of a if this, then that, you know. Unfortunately, aroma science doesn't work that way. Let me give you an example. So as we all know, and we've all experienced, you know, you'll be somewhere and you'll get a whiff of something on the air. And for me, it's like freshly mown grass. And whenever I smell that, it takes me back to my childhood, you know, playing around in the summertime and having my dad cooking out on the grill. And just that smell immediately transports me back. It's very, very vivid.
Yep, I have that as well. And I have it in a very, it's very timely right now, the smell of chlorine bleach. I was, which you know, everyone's busy using. I was a lifeguard for several years during at the end of high school, and the smell of chlorine just takes me back to, you know, being a teenager at the pool. I love the smell. Most people hate the smell of cleaning products. I just sit down and waft it in.
So that's, you all know what Greg's signature body scent is.
Oh yeah. Axe spray chlorine scent.
Yeah. Chlorine. You bet. So that the ability to do that is having a sensory experience completely transport you back to someplace else. Think about that. Rarely happens with vision, right? Our primary sense. Sometimes that can happen with sound, but usually it's scent, it's aroma. So it's aroma has a particular connection to your deep, deep brain that the other senses don't. Because it's rooted so deeply in our deep, deep, I call it lizard brain, different people can have different experiences when exposed to the same stimuli, so the same aroma or same scent. We're not used to that as humans because what we see is what is real, or at least that's what we tell ourselves. So being able to say, you know, we could show a panel of people a bunch of paint chips, and they could all generally agree that blue is blue, but some people may say, yeah, that's more teal, or some people say, yeah, that's more aquamarine, but are they blue? Yeah, they're generally blue because it's one color. It's one thing that they're looking at. Now, imagine that with an aroma where you've got it all mixed together. Imagine it with a painting, like a Jackson Pollock painting, which just smears and splatters all over the place. And you say, what color is that?
And it's, people are like, it's every color, but it's no color.
Right. So it's like, well, what do you mean? I don't understand. Well, what color is it? Well, I don't know. It's just, there's so much going on there. How do you tell what is one color? It's, yeah, it's every color, but it's not one color. So the further you step back away from it, from that painting, you start to lose resolution, and it starts to take on more and more of a general tone. And at that point, people could say, oh, it's kind of purple, or it's more gray, or it's, you know, something like that. But the closer you get to it, the more resolution that you gain. You can't call it just one thing. Mm-hmm. So that's like the visual equivalent to trying to dissect aroma from something as complex as a hop cone.
Yeah, there's so much going on in there. And to your point, everyone, not only do you have to absorb it and figure out what part of it you're sensing, everyone's sensitive to different types of things as well. So you may feel a heavy berry flavor and someone else is getting the pine out of it a little more so. But then you have to translate it into words, which is not something most people are very good at.
Correct. So you've got trying to translate it. You've got some physiological impacts of some people being more sensitive than others. And we've talked about my sensitivity to sulfurs, which is very unfortunate in the hop world right now. But then you also have your stupid brain trying to influence what you're going to consciously experience. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's sort of, you're seeing what this thing is, and your brain is already making assumptions about what you think it's going to smell like. And that doesn't help at all. And so that muddies the water too.
Well, and the assumption piece, this is that sensory dysphoria thing that I think we've talked about.
Right, correct.
And my example for that is always, if you pick up a glass that you think has milk in it, and you bring it to your lips and take a drink, and it actually had orange juice, you may love orange juice, but your brain was prepared for milk, and you go, ugh.
Exactly. But if your brain was prepared for orange juice, you would have had a different sensory experience.
Absolutely.
shutting that part off when one is doing sensory evaluations is extremely important. Otherwise, it's going to completely jade what you're doing. And people are going to say, how do you do that? And say, you have to learn how to do it. And it's not something you can really read through a book. It's something you need to be trained to do. Mm-hmm. So we're going to assume that everyone can do that as we're talking about this. And I'll try my best to explain to you how to do that. Because I see this all the time at Siebel when we're doing aroma, like hop rubs. And I'm trying to teach them how to shut their brain off and just use your nose almost like a gas chromatograph, where it's like you're smelling all this stuff at once. Your brain is wants to immediately make sense of it, but you have to force it to stop. You have to force it to ignore some of the stimuli and focus on one aspect or another to really drill into it. That takes practice.
Oh, sure.
So,
and a lot of drinking.
Doing that with beer as opposed to with a raw hop is a totally different monster, because then you have to take into account taste. So you have two potential sensory inputs that are very, very finicky and wacky, such to the point where you can have all kinds of sensory dysphoria going on, which is why people have a hard time of describing beer in words. You know, adjectives, and they tend to go to adverbs or experiences or sense memories. Why people say, oh, this has essence of old shoe leather. Really? You eat old shoe leather? What does that mean? Right? It's this combination of when you're drinking, you've got taste and aroma combining to provide an experience that you're trying to put into words that you otherwise don't have a descriptor for.
Sure. You know, we've talked about earthy before. That's a very common descriptor of hops. And what in God's name does that mean from a flavor perspective? Who wants to eat earthy?
Right. I have never experienced a hop that is described as earthy that evokes what I believe earthy is, which would be freshly tilled soil. Not something I'm looking for in a hop, to be honest with you, but it's a descriptor. Somebody said it's earthy. It's really, in, you know, when people are trying to describe flavors, they usually are like using their arms and their hands and there's like body gestures, because we just don't have the language for it. It's almost a purely experiential science. And to say earthy, we could dig into the compounds that are producing those, that earthiness, but like the smell of soil that's, you know, freshly tilled or like potting soil, right? That absolutely characteristic aspect of soil or dirt is coming from a compound called geosmin. That is not anywhere in hops at all. So that aspect of earthy is not what people are using in their minds. That's not what they're describing as earthy. It must mean something else. What does that mean?
Yep. And I'm looking right now at a hop chart from BSG with aroma and flavor characteristics on it. And some of the descriptions make sense. Okay. Pineapple. I get it. I get pineapple. I get passion fruit. A lot of the fruit ones make sense, but green wood, what in God's name is that supposed to invoke? Mm-hmm. Fresh hay, you know, tangy herbal. There are things that you have to use your imagination for a bit to figure these things out.
Yeah, but it's okay. So green wood and fresh hay. If you're a city girl or a city boy, do you even know what that smells like?
Probably not.
Right. So what the hell is the point of using that as a descriptor? Whoever was writing this had an experience that says, oh, this reminds me of blank. Okay, great. So you're a farm boy and you know exactly what wet hay smells like, or green hay, but nobody else does.
Mm-hmm.
How do you describe that for people? It's not easy, especially when you're trying to describe something as ephemeral as an aroma.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think you would read through these characteristics I'm reading and go, that's not what I'm getting. Some of them are very specific.
Right.
Many of them are very fruity and, you know, specific fruits, but like here's one. I think this is fascinating. Intense wintergreen, eucalyptus, and green apple candy.
Now, that's something I think most people can relate to.
Yes. Any guesses?
They would say, and certainly like relating aromas to flavors people have experienced, like, you know, Jolly Rancher candies or something like that, where we could say green apple. What was it?
Wintergreen, eucalyptus, and green apple candy.
So that's something that we would consider to be very herbal, yet green apple-y, and that makes me think farnesene. And wintergreen?
Yep, wintergreen. It says intense wintergreen.
Intense wintergreen. Is it Northern Brewer?
It is not. It is German, though.
What is it?
Polaris.
Yeah, I don't get that. intense wintergreen. Let's explore that a second. The reason why I wouldn't get that is I know the chemical compounds that produce the wintergreen aroma. They're in a class of compounds that sometimes people consider to be solvent-like. So I could see if some, and wintergreen as a, both as a plant, as an essential oil, can be very solvent-like in high concentrations, right? It smells like a cleaning fluid. So I could see that someone might consider that solvent-y kind of essence to be wintergreen. Mm-hmm. I probably would have described it as solvent-like. But that's not very, that doesn't evoke good images.
No, it does not.
That evokes like giant open vats of like, toluene and hexane.
That's up there with me and the obsession with chlorine bleach. Yeah, that's
exactly
not good.
So somebody would say, oh, if I, James described it as solvent like, oh, that's a bad one. No, I described it purely in, you know, as empirically as I could. It's got very strong solvent character. Now, some people would say, oh, that smells like wintergreen. And other people would say, no, it doesn't. It smells like, you know, whatever. So you have to be very, very careful. But at some point, we have been able to agree on certain aspects of these, you know, aromas. Like you said, pineapple. Most people understand what pineapple is, right? Mm-hmm. But the way pineapple smells and the way pineapple tastes are two different things, right?
Yes.
They're closely related. So when we're grinding it up, you know, doing the mashup in our hands and you're like, you get a whiff, you're like, okay, wow. What's the first thing I get? What's the first thing that hits me? And don't be fooled by, you know, second guessing yourself, because there's really no wrong answer. It's like, what do you smell out of this? Then you leave it set a minute. So what you're doing is that first blast that you get is what we call the top note. That is the most volatile chemical compounds that are in there. So they require the least amount of heat to volatilize. And even just grinding them up and breaking open the lupulin glands is enough energy to make them turn into gas, basically. So that's the top note. So that's going to be the first thing that you're going to get hit with. Wham! Then leave it set. Keep it in your hand. Put it on a, you know, in the sun, someplace warm. I don't care, after you've ground it up. And leave it set for a few minutes. And let all those other, those light compounds flash off. Then smell it again. Now you're down into what we call the mid-tones, right? Or the mid-level aromas. And those are bigger compounds that take more energy to volatilize than the top note does, right? Mm-hmm. Then you leave it set for another few minutes. Let those flash off. It might actually take longer. You usually hold them in your hand, add a little extra heat, and then huff them again. And now you've got the base notes, and these are the gigantic freight train molecules, and they take a huge amount of energy to flash off and volatilize. And each one of those levels have general characteristics, right? So the top level, top note, is more of your floral and sort of what we would consider sweet fruit, like apples and strawberries and, you know, that kind of stuff, even some citrus. And then the second level is more of the spices. Think about cinnamon. Think about coriander, think about even things like pineapple and tropical fruits live in that second level. They are bigger molecules. They're usually bound with sulfur, which is why they take more energy to volatilize typically. And then at the very base, you have your heavy molecules, the big giant freighter molecules. And those are usually associated with herbal. So you've got a lot of those compounds that people associate with marijuana down there, humulene and caryophyllene. You've got like cedar and...
is that pine maybe you'd find there?
Pine might be in the second level. Doesn't take a lot of energy to volatilize, but certainly in the third level you would find it, probably in the second level. Things that smell like, and again, things that smell like decomposing wood.
Earthy.
Right? Dank.
Oh, you hate that word.
I do, yes. But that's what people are describing. They're describing this musky, damp basement, almost rotting vegetation kind of aroma. And it's down there. It's there. People like it a lot. Also, things like black currant and other aromas that are linked to flavors of things that we could put in our mouth and equate them to.
I feel like currently, and for a while now, you know, IPA and whatnot, those mid-tones seem to be where the focus are in terms of beer styles. In the cinnamons and the tropical fruits and the coriander, that's more where I think you're, at least the advertising part. This is an IPA that has, you know, this and this in it.
Well, tropical fruit is huge.
Yeah.
So melon falls in that tier two. Papaya and mango and all that kind of stuff falls in that tier two. What also falls, what people associate those tropical fruits with and melon are amplified by the essence of these sulfur compounds that are extremely volatile, but they're also present in wicked, stupid, tiny amounts that humans are sensitive to in the parts per trillion. And to give you an idea what a parts per trillion is, go into a gymnasium, spread a layer of white sand on the floor, put one pink grain in there, and be able to spot it immediately. That's the level that humans are sensitive to these sulfur compounds. And so they add this kicker to these other components that are contributing to mango and papaya and pineapple, right? So as you add a little bit more of that sulfur to it, it makes those compounds more tropical fruity.
Yep.
Except to me, it makes it smell like cat piss.
Right.
So therein lies that physiological component to the aroma science, where you may not be sensitive to it. And you're like, oh, wow, I like this. It's really tropical fruity, which people are now calling juicy. If you were to take that sulfur component out, I think you'd find that intensity to be much less. So it's sort of like a kicker molecule for the aroma components that are already in there. So to wrap this all up, as hop growers, you are going to be interacting with brewers that are going to be expecting certain things based on what they're told their hops need to smell like. Cascade's going to smell like, well, a cascade. Well, what is that essence? Well, it's generally got a healthy note of pine. It's got a healthy note of grapefruit and just sort of general citrus, but not any particular like lemons or oranges or grapefruit. It's there. It's just a sort of this generic citrus melange. And like Tettnanger or Saaz, you know, they better freaking have a farnesene bite to it, which is going to be like that green apple that you described earlier, Greg. But it's also going to have a lot of heavy herbal and spice notes to it. You're going to need to build this vocabulary that you can talk to your brewers with, especially if they don't have any experience using whatever that particular variety that you have are trying to sell them.
Yep, we've talked about this before from a marketing perspective that you do not need to become a brewer to sell your hops, but you do need to be able to speak their language to some degree. And when they do show up and they huff the hops and say, this seems a little danker than I think it should be, you need to know how to react to that and either what else to point them toward or how to explain why that may or may not be an accurate critique of their, right, hops.
Yep, that's, and you know, you could stop there in your sensory education. That could be enough. That should be the absolute minimum that you are able to do. You don't necessarily need to know why yours are different at any given time. It helps in the situation, like in the moment, to be able to explain it. But you have to have a pretty healthy awareness if you're going to be successful doing this.
Yep. And to your point earlier, I mean, as I was reading my chart here with these set descriptions that came from someone who grew up, mm-hmm, in some part of wherever and their nose, and you didn't necessarily resonate with their descriptions, reading about these descriptions, it isn't enough. My suggestion would be to read about some of them, but you've still got to do your own research on your own crop and kind of figure out what they all mean to you so you can have that conversation. And just like you, James, are incredibly sensitive to sulfur, it's okay during that conversation to say, you're getting, when the brewer says, I'm getting a lot of pine out of this, say, huh, I'm not getting pine, I'm getting so-and-so. It's okay to make that a discussion and not a right and wrong type of thing, because everyone does sense these things a little differently.
Correct. That's absolutely correct. And you can't really make excuses. It's not bad. It's not good. It's just what that brewer finds in that hop. And if he doesn't or she doesn't want pine in that hop for that beer, okay, sorry. Not much I can do about it.
Now, as we, you know, what's interesting here is, as we talked about the whole milk orange juice thing, your brain can do a lot to affect your sensory perception. So if you hand a brewer something to huff and say, yeah, this is my whatever it is, and I'm getting nice notes of pine and coriander out of it, they're going to lean toward getting that as well.
Yeah, absolutely they will. People are so easily influenced through aroma, less so through taste, because I think it's more physical for people, but certainly through aroma. And you can lead people like nobody's business. So be careful of that. And the only time I lead people is when I'm training them and saying, okay, this is what we're going to do. We talked about the top note and the mid note and the bass note. We talked about what the characteristics of this hop are supposed to be. Now, you tell me what you find and use your words to describe what you're experiencing. Don't say it's like a rainy afternoon when the asphalt is damp. I'm like, no. You're not using your words.
That's great for a Playboy centerfold.
right.
It's
right,
not yeah. great for flavor profile.
Correct. So it's fine for aromas to elicit an image in your mind. That's fine, but you have to be able to describe it, and man, is that difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, takes practice. And again, you know, man, everyone's different. Everyone has different reactions to these things.
It's so funny. It's like after our session, this is what we do at the end of day with the brewers, and they're exhausted. They're just like, you know, they were looking forward to it all day, and we're into it for half an hour, and they're just like, I'm spent. He's like, I got nothing. My nose, I can't, nothing smell. Everything smells the same now. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. You have to train yourself to not inhale so deeply and to take breaks and to, you know, they are tired. They're just like, I just want to drink a beer. And it's like, fine, let's open up the taps and let's have a beer. And we start drinking beer, and their noses are wrecked.
I'm sure. That's interesting.
And so it's like, and so then they don't end up drinking much because that whole sensory experience is blown now. And yeah, the pints of beer don't go down so quickly.
You know, it's funny. We live about an hour and change from a Yankee Candle outlet. And we'll go there once every couple of years. It's fun to wander around. And they have little cups of coffee beans everywhere for kind of clearing your nose, mm-hmm. for restarting yourself. But after about, you know, the first half an hour or so of excitedly smelling everything, I just have a wicked headache. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, those smells are very intentionally in your face and perfumed and artificial, so it's certainly different than trying to get a natural hit off of hops. But I can see how spending a whole day of really trying to identify things through your nose, it's got to be exhausting.
Oh, yeah. And there's only so much you can do. Mm-hmm. And you have to know when to stop. But trying to do that for even a half an hour for an untrained person can completely blow out your palate, such to the point where, you know, you're drinking Busch Light and you're okay with it. Anyway,
that's a phrase that should never be said.
Anyway, that's all the deeper I think we have time to go into for this topic now. Otherwise, we're going to start talking chemistry and nobody wants that. So
very true. And if anyone doesn't know it, I mean, you mentioned it earlier, but if you check out James's, if you stalk James online, mm-hmm. and you see that he is a staff member at the Siebel Institute, this is one of the three or four things that you teach is sensory science.
Correct. Yep.
So this was a very base level cursory view on the top. The fact that I understood most of the words tells you that, you know, you didn't get nearly as deep as that can go. Again, if you stalk James online like I do, you already knew this.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know a lot of other things that we don't need to talk about right now.
No. That's for my other podcast all about James that you're not involved with, where I talk about you.
Nice.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of crossover listeners.
You've been talking about that rash that I've got down in the, you know, well, probably not.
We had your doctor. Anyway. We had your doctor on last week to give us.
Did you? Yeah. Yeah. Well, tell Anne I said hi.
She's going to be she's going to be calling you. She has some news.
Okay, good. All right. So you've got to have at least something to share and talk about today.
Who, me? What?
Yes. Yes. What are we going to talk about on your side of things?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. Yeah, so, you know, the Brewers Association, interestingly enough, we talk about them quite a bit because they've got great information. They just had some furloughs. They've reduced their staff.
The actual Brewers Association.
Yeah. Right after I paid my annual membership fee, interestingly enough. I think they were waiting for that. Then
maybe they're using our funds responsibly.
I'm going to trust that that's what's happening. You know, mm-hmm. I would never disparage them. They do good work. They have a lot of interesting stuff. But their cover article this week is called "What Will On-Premise Look Like This Summer?" And it's actually fascinating, especially as some states start to reopen. So it is May the 2nd, just to, you know, this will probably drop in about a week and a half onto iTunes and whatnot. So just to give people some perspective, by the time you hear this, we're going to know pretty well if the states that are starting to reopen a bit, like Colorado and Georgia and Minnesota, if things are working or if things take a nosedive in terms of public health. We'll know by then what's happening, I think. But the real question they're asking, and I think it's an important one for all of us to think about, is consumer behavior and what's really going to happen. It's one thing to open these places up. It's another to, you know, do you really think you're going to see a brewery that's wall-to-wall people waiting three deep in line to get a beer at a bar and pushing your way around other bodies? I'm not sure what to expect. I love going out to a brewery, and that never bothered me before, but it bothers me now, and I'm not sure how long it's going to bother me for.
I was partaking of the Vintage's drive-through service because they have a restaurant, and I saw somebody out there power washing their patio. And of course they have four locations, but at this particular location, they're out there power washing their patio and getting the patio into good shape. So they're clearly expecting here in Madison, once the lockdown is over, that people will be coming back and they will be having an in-person, you know, experience again. But to your point, what does that look like?
Yep.
You know, are they moving half of their tables out of there? So social distancing is a thing or what? I don't think it's appropriate to expect that people are going to want to come and sit down, you know, butt to butt with each other again for, you know, a good long time. So when space is at a premium and you're trying to cram as many people in as you can so that, you know, you're making as much money as you can off the resources you've got. Now, if you're saying, okay, I can only have half as many people in there.
Does that even pay your rent?
Right, exactly. How do you do that? Mm-hmm. How do you do that and still manage to operate? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very true. I mean, even just the staff that you'll need to run that. Now, granted, let's use half as easy math. If you can only have half the folks in, does that mean you need half the cooks and half the wait staff and half the cleaning? You probably need double the cleaning staff. But yeah, what does that do? Is it worthwhile to have that staff for half of the folks who are in to eat? I know here in Connecticut, we haven't opened up yet. They're talking about the next evaluation date being around the 20th of May. But what they're saying are things like, we'll open restaurants, but it's takeout. It's outside seating only. Now, I've got two breweries right here nearby. One has outdoor seating. One does not. They've had permit issues with the town one over from me. They may not be able to open for other than curbside pickup if they have no outside seating. And even the outside seating, you've got to come inside to get a beer. Are you allowed inside to pick up? I don't know how that's going to work. Don't know how it's going to work.
It's a lot of new. And yes. It's going to be a lot of experimenting going on. But if there's anything that entrepreneurs are good at, is experimenting. Mm-hmm. And they certainly will come up with a solution. But businesses are going to have to change their expectations, their revenue models, their growth and shrinking plans. And man, oh man, have I been seeing the word pivot thrown around a lot.
I have too. I thought it was it was our thing, but apparently not.
Nope.
Seeing a lot of pivot. So there are, me with my numbers, there are some interesting numbers in some surveys that were done. So a consumer survey that was done at the end of April, 20% of consumers said they would absolutely dine in right away when restaurants reopen. 40% not sure, and the other 40% saying no way in hell. And that, of course, varies by age. The younger folks are more likely, and the older folks, like myself, are less likely to dine in. The other that I thought was really interesting, just the point made by the author of this particular article, and I think this is a really good point, that whatever works to get that first third to half of your customers in the door is not the same thing that's going to work to get the remaining people in the door. It's going to be mm-hmm. that second half of your population that's very nervous, immune compromised, or maybe not even immune compromised, maybe just still nervous and scared about being out in public. How far are you willing to go as an on-premise business to cater to that chunk? Now, whether that chunk is 80% of your former audience or 50% or 30% or 5%, that's the tricky one. No one knows the answer to that. But how far do you go to make things acceptable to enough of the population that you end up having a solid business?
Yeah.
If you can only accept half of your prior capacity anyway, you probably don't have to go to that nth degree. There are folks that are just not going to come back, and there's no room for them anyway.
Well, yeah, that's part of it, is all of this success that, let's call it success. It is success for those who have started it. I was going to say success, but expansion and just volume of craft beer out there is a lot of it a trend? Is it the hip thing to do because it was the hip thing to do until something changes what hip is? And I suspect there's a good portion of the breweries that are out there that will close and not reopen fall into that category because now it's not in vogue anymore to gather in large numbers and to X, Y, or Z, and people are going to change their tune, and there's just attrition because of that.
Yep. Yeah, there absolutely will be. It will be so interesting to see how this all plays out. And of course, the other piece is discretionary spending. It's one thing where folks say, I've got to get out, I want to go sit in a restaurant. But you've got plenty of folks whose jobs aren't back, and may not be back at that point, especially if they're in the service industry. And these, you know, it's chicken or the egg here. These restaurants that may only be able to take half capacity, we just said maybe they only need half their chefs, half their servers. Well, those people without jobs are not going out and spending money in other places, in other restaurants. So it's this cycle.
Correct. It's a vicious cycle that there's place for injecting, you know, capital, but I'm not going to go all political right now. So, but yeah, I think we can expect to see different, and different we're going to have to be okay with, you know, taking my team out for beers, as part of our happy hour may and will look a lot different than it did before. Mm-hmm.
Well, heck, even the prospect of your team all being in the office on the same day of the week is going to look different than it used to. That's the I mean, we're talking tap rooms here, but on the office life side of things, my desk and my coworker's desk, which are basically just tables, are not six feet apart from each other.
Right.
So
we'll see.
We're having those conversations about our you know, do you rotate employees in their home some days and in some days so you can limit bodies in enclosed spaces. We happen to have a porch, an outside porch at the office, and someone suggested, well, we can all work out on the porch, except then it will look like a tap room where we're all, you know, elbow to elbow. It'll be funny, and we'll probably break the porch and come crashing into the parking lot.
I just need to set up a bunch of dog kennels. Just put your desk in a dog kennel, a chain link, you know.
Nice. That's kind of like what it is now.